Now, Rick, as being from Toronto, Ontario, with lakes, I've been interested in forest fires since I was very young. It's really quite an experience to be on a canoe trip and you go through an area with forest fires. It's really like being in some, I'm not trying to correct you, but I'm just the sort of the emotional side of forest fires. I mean, when you go through a lake and there's just no birds and no vegetation and so on, it's like being in a cathedral in Europe or something like that. Anyway, so for some reason you put me talking on a Thursday, and says there are no fires to put out, so I decided perhaps I should have some seismology in my talk, I'm thankful that I'm getting to give my talk. So, oh dear, we're in some sort of trouble here, aren't we? Well, well, all my ad-libbing will actually be over on the right-hand and side there, I guess. So, here's my website. I guess that's the important bit of information there for you. And here we have the layout of the talk. So, I'm going to some introductory words and then some statistics. Then I'm going to talk a bit about a particular earthquake, and then I'll talk about wildfire risk for a particular area. And then the thing I find that really binds together many questions of risk analysis is the question of, well, what sort of premium would you charge to insure against this risk realizing itself and so on. It makes you break the problem down into compartments and really consider the problem from the beginning to the end. And I mean, the end is money, so that's a pretty well-determined entity. So the data I'm going to be talking about became available. I'm sort of stuck here, aren't I? Give me a moment, please. Let's think. What do I want to do here? I'm not sure quite what to do. Well, David Beer Jones had a story about computing, so, you know, all of us older guys have stories about computing, and the one I'm remembering right now is Berkeley set up an array. We had like 30 computers in our department, and you could run them like one that's making a lot of trouble. That one. So I had a major computing problem to work on, and so Phil Spector, the computer guy in our department, had a program that lets you run on all the computers simultaneously, and so I started a program running on it. After it was running about 10 minutes, I realized there was a mistake in my program, so I wanted to stop it. But Phil hadn't thought to put in a stopping mechanism in this program. So I had to go around to 30 computers in our department, stopping the program on each of them. Now, let me sort of just try something, too, here.
I'm not sure what I'm looking for
here. Yeah, well, how do I get out of this thing? This is what I'm trying to do at this point. What do we got down here? Oops. End show. Okay. Oh, that worked. There we go. Let's just do that. All right. Oh, had it. Yeah, it's almost there. Can you just shrink it a bit more? 16 to 9. No. Okay, I'll go with this. It's okay. Don't worry. What, when you've made it bigger then, can we just see it again? The thing you did just before that, yeah. Is it just the same picture? Yeah. No, it's the other way. Yeah. No. Okay. That don't worry. Really, I'm serious. Don't worry. We're good. I had trouble with my talk in Australia, and they kept saying, "She'll be good, David. She'll be right. the New Zealanders say, "She'll be Jake," and it was Jake in the end. So, okay. So my first example concerns the Lisbon earthquake. It's the 250th anniversary of that earthquake this November, and some data turned up from that. The King of Spain, a week after the earthquake, sent people around Spain to make to record the damage that had taken place in the various Spanish towns of that point. And then this data basically disappeared. And then some Spanish scientists found this in the records a few years ago, so this data has now become available. And I'm getting ready to talk for, there's a meeting in Lisbon in November concerned with the earthquake. So this is preparatory material for that earthquake, for that meeting. Okay, so they didn't have photographs to take back then. I mean, the thing about earthquakes nowadays is you see these pictures of statues. There's a famous picture of Stanford after the 1906 earthquake, Stanford University campus. There was a statue that tumbled over, and head first, the person on the top of it, maybe Leland Stanford, went into the ground. So, but there were lots of artists back there, and so here are some etchings going along with these places. And you see, I had this secret note to myself. So we got St. Paul's Cathedral, St. Paul's Church, the Cathedral, the Opera House, this one, and St. Nicholas Church, and I'm connected to fields. The signal strength is good. Well, excellent would be better, I suppose. It's always fun with computers. Okay, so that's just some evidence of the damage. And now what's happened to me? The arrows aren't working. Well, I don't know. Yeah, my signal strength is good. Look, they're not working. It's okay. Go away, you guys. Leave me. Okay. Can anybody see? Come on, you can do it. There. See. Okay. So now I have my note down here as to what this is. But this is a convent that I write the name down. Yeah, the Carmel convent. And after the great earthquake, the Portuguese left this standing as a memorial to the earthquake, and I gather it's still there now. And someone was very clever, waiting until the moon was up. I'll get there, people. Those who don't know what the moon looks like, there is the moon. Okay. Please be patient. And then so those were some etchings and a modern photograph I showed you, and then there were some oil paintings that came out of this, and so we have the angels and people being sick and dealt with. Okay, so this is the introduction now. So I'm going to be concerned with risk analysis. I was going to be an actuary for many years, and my best friend from high school, John Gardner, is in the back of the room there. He did become an actuary and president of Sun Life of Canada, and now he's director of the Fields Institute. So we've sort of had careers quite different, but we've merged in this room, which is sort of fun. And in risk analysis, point processes are abound. So my concern here then is going to be earthquakes and wildfires and then some insurance issues. And one thing you'll see I'm focusing on is having mark point processes with the marks being ordinal. So here's some of the data now. So I apologize to the person from Coimbra in the audience. Portugal's all about, but it's over here. So the Spaniards, when they made their map and so on of the data, it was all data for Spain. So here we have Spain. And the thing so zero means there was a building, say, and it wasn't damaged. And these are intensity values, and I'm going to be giving some examples of their verbal description. It's ordinal data. That's the distinction here. And then down here, here we have some eights and so on. And this is the epicenter of the earthquake, and it's out in the ocean. So Portugal is coming across here. So here we have a description of these intensities. There are a number of intensity scales that are used. This is the European macroseismic scale. One, it's not felt even under very favorable circumstances. Two, it's scarcely felt. And so when you go down to strong, earthquake is felt indoors by most, outdoors by few, sleeping people awake, and so on. And then that continues. And so the thing to note is it's ordinal. It's usually denoted by Roman numerals, but where I got this slide from the web, they had numerical numbers there and so on. So up to 12, completely devastating and so on. Practically all structures above and below ground are heavily damaged or destroyed. So you saw some of the measurements. There are a lot more measurements, but the the picture would have been crowded by them. Okay, so just some elementary statistical background. So a planar point process is what I'm talking about for the moment. So you have latitude and longitude, say, and Rick mentioned that I did time series. Well, this makes point processes into time series analysis. You just use the Dirac delta function there. It's infinity when you land on the point and zero otherwise. Now, I'm going to be principally concerned with marked point processes, so there's another measurement that goes along with each of the points, and so the size of the fire would be the cost of the fire, the example of the earthquake case. The seismic damage would be is going to be my particular example. Now, this earthquake was 250 years ago, and yet we can learn an amazing amount from it, even though they didn't have seismometers and things back then, because of this data that was collected in space and at the time of the earthquake. Because it is quasi-numerical, it's being ordinal. And there are questions that go along with the mark point process, like David Peter Jones talked about it. Are the marks assigned randomly to the points, for example? Now, I'm also going to be talking about spatial-temporal point processes, and I guess it's all there. So my reference is David Beer Jones, 2005, some models and procedures for space-time point processes. So you know it all at this point, and it'll be on the web in a bit. Then now models for marks. So they're in the book by McCullough and Nelder. They make a distinction between measurements on an interval scale, which is a numerical scale, on an ordinal scale, where there's an ordering of the values, and the characteristic thing is that you can merge adjacent categories and it still makes sense, and then things that are just totally exchangeable, they're of quite different character, quite different units, for example. And the most information goes with the interval scale, next with the ordinal scale, and a third with the nominal scale. And the thing is, these seismologists have used these intensities in a numerical way. I've made them the response in the regression equations and things of that sort. And there's sort of an interplay between what they've been finding and the definitions of the scale and so on. So in some sense, my talk is a bit about to what degree can you actually use these ordinal labels as numbers and so on. Goals, few parameters, sensitivity, interpretability, insight and understanding, the usual things in statistics. Okay, now for ordinal data, the model I'm going to use is the so-called group continuous model. And basically you assume the existence of a state variable, zeta, and some cut points. And if the state variable, which you typically do not measure, I'll be concerned with estimating it in fact, if it falls between the cut point J minus 1 and the cut point J, then what would be recorded would be, what would be observed would be the ordinal level J and so on. And now I'm picturing the J as taking on numerical values and so on. Okay, and then to proceed, I'm going to have a model, and to proceed to the fitting of that model, I'm going to use maximum likelihood estimation, and the these categories are very dependent. We're going to be getting the probability that, say, category J turns up, multiplying these conditional probabilities together and so on. So that one should be probably Y equals 2, given Y is not 2, and so on. Through the last one that you see J, given it was not one of the lower categories, and so on. All right, so we have a variety of explanatories in both the forest fire case and the seismology case. We call those X. And we're going to picture that zeta comes about from our explanatories up to some random error there, random variable. Uh-oh, what am I doing here? I don't want to cut anything, then I'd really be in trouble. And there we go. Okay, and so for that random variable that's being added on to get to the variability, we're going to take the extreme value distribution, and it has this particular form here. And what that leads to in terms of a model is the probability that category J comes up, given that some category J are greater, has on this particular form here. So those of you know about the generalized linear model, you'll see exactly where I'm heading here. And then the thing that makes the parameterization I'm using here very useful is an idea due to Daryl Prejibon. I'm pretty sure he had that when he was a graduate student here at Toronto, that these two probabilities have the same functional form if you're proceeding with the extreme value distribution, except that this parameter here changes. Now, this theta, that's the cut point. So this is a different parameter when you're getting involved in that probability. But I'm involved with that probability because that's how I'm going to get the likelihood by multiplying these conditional probabilities together. The connection between the two parameters is given by this thing here. And so basically it comes down to modeling the probability that we have, say, intensity J, given our explanatories, has this particular form over here. You can argue for the extreme value distribution because this is an extreme situation when damage is taking place. So the way I'm going to proceed is I'm going to want to be fitting the model, but then I'm going to be wanting to know which cell does a particular fitted value fall into. So basically I need to estimate the so-called linear predictor, zeta hat, and I'm going to put that there, and then this is Euler's constant, Math Institute, so we can talk about Euler's constant, and it's the expected value of the extreme value distribution. So this is my fitted value I'm going to be using, and then I'm going to see, and part of the estimation is going to be estimates of the thetas, and I'm going to see which cell the particular fitted value of theta falls into. And the inference, there's a variety of inference methods that are going to be used. Max and Blake, they've been talking about, at this point, finite parameter model, generalized linear model, I'm making use of that, generalized additive model, and the forest fire asks, I'll be talking about that, and then this is something that's being worked on now, VSAG models, you've met Rolf Turner, he's talked about Adrian Badley and so on, and they have this package here, and I was going to publicize it, but he sort of mentioned it a fair amount already, and then assessment of fit. You can, you know, I was going to say you need all the publicity you can get, Rolf, but then I realized that didn't apply to you. You're all right anyway. Okay, so now we go to the seismic case. So the data we have are intensities, and nowadays the intensities are, information is now being input to the USGS, United States Geological Survey, by people sitting at home using the web. Suppose there's an earthquake in L.A., well, you can go to a website and you just tell them, my chimney fell down into my son's car or something of that sort, and then they would convert that to so-called modified Mercalli intensity, and as the evening or day is going on, they're building up an intensity map. So they've come a long way from having to send a team around Spain to record the data. But the thing is that historical data is incredibly important for the seismic engineers in designing their buildings and so on. So historically, it's very important. Data are ordinal. One of the questions I'll be approaching is how to smooth it, how to display it. And then I mentioned this question. They have been used numerically, but even though they're Roman numerals. John, do you remember we had a teacher in physics in grade 12 who claimed to be able to take square roots of Roman numerals? Where'd John go? There he is. Do you remember that guy? He stood up at the board and he wrote down some Roman numeral and then the square root sign and he was working away. You don't remember that? Yeah. Okay. Anyway, and then I'm also going to be talking about getting attenuation laws, that a functional form for the decay of the energy as it moves away from the earthquake. Okay, so Lisbon, 1755, 1st of November, All Saints Day. And you see down here, I've mentioned Voltaire. A lot of people read some real significance into the date of occurrence of this earthquake. And Voltaire wrote a poem about it. And Candide, he talks about this earthquake. And it really started a discussion amongst the intellectuals of the time about whether or not this proved God didn't exist or proved God existed and things of that sort and so on. Now, we have some more evidence about the existence of God, perhaps, because the great Alaskan earthquake was on Good Friday in 1964 or something like that. Anyway, magnitude 8.3 to 9.0, so this is a very, there's a range of values. and they've had to infer this value from the area over which the earthquake was felt. They talk about it having several minutes duration. Now, these great earthquakes, you actually can still measure them like a month later. The earth is still vibrating, but this must be just people sensing it standing on solid ground or something of that sort. A great variability in the number of deaths, 50 to 70,000. Major event. Talked about the epicenter was in the Atlantic. Now, one, you know, the Japanese have a word for a tragedy of which something good comes. And earthquakes are like that. I mean, every time there's an earthquake, the engineers, for example, are surprised and they learn better how to design buildings as a result. Now, I'm sort of something good that came out of the Indonesian earthquake was that now everybody says tsunami. Until this point, everybody said tidal wave, but now they finally realize it doesn't have, that the papers, I guess, have realized that it's not a tidal wave at all. And there were fires. So many people were dying. Many people died because when the earthquake came, the buildings collapsed and there were fires. Being a seagoing nation, they fled to boats and they went in the river. But then the tidal wave came up the river. Twice a tidal wave came. What did I say? You know, I'll do that in class, and all of a sudden the class is laughing. And I think, what were they laughing about? You know, I guess I could have done that here. Anyway, two tsunamis came up the river. And then a week after the event was the Royal Inquiry. I'm going to pull things down a bit here. Okay, so here's the model that I'm going to be using. So the measurement is the intensity as interpreted by the and I'll have them just a bit, the Spanish seismologist. So they took the verbal descriptions of the earthquake and they put them up against that table and came up with some intensity value. So here's the model I'm fitting. Basically, the intensity that it's less than or equal to J at location x, y, latitude, longitude, has this particular form here. The theta J are the cut points. Remember, I have this model with a state variable lurking in the background. And then an assumption that it depends smoothly on x and y. So this is generalized additive model material at that point. And here's what I got when I took the model. So over here was the location of the earthquake, and here's the scale. And so you see the energy dying off as we move away from the source of the earthquake. But there's some curiosities that are there. Now that makes one wonder if perhaps it's due to the location of the value. So over here we actually have the locations of the measurements. So here we have the population centers in Spain and so on. So. To get an intensity, there has to have been someone there or a building there or something of that sort. So it could well be that there just weren't people here. It might be no damage. There are people and buildings, but no damage took place. But it could be just that there was nothing there to be destroyed and so on. So when you're interpreting this map here, you have to have in mind this picture here. And depending on the question you're going to ask, you're going to be involving each of these two. This is, for those who are interested, this picture is made with R. I'll have the reference for this in a bit, but this is the map of isoseismals. Isoseismals is meant to sort of be a line, a contour that lurks within here. It's meant to be represent that the intensity is Roman numeral 4 and so on. Now, typically these have been hand drawn. And I think this one was hand-drawn. And but the last 10 years or so, they've taken to having some sort of automatic smoothing, but they've been smoothing with the values as if they were numerical. Now we've got Portugal in the picture, and I think Lisbon's up here, I guess. And here was the epicenter of the earthquake. And so on. So we're hoping to have... This is work with Bruce Bold, who is director of the seismographic stations at Berkeley. He recently retired. So he's hoping to get data for Portugal. The other thing he's expecting to get is data on the geology. So here I'm just fitting the dependence upon the location. But there'd be sites that have good support and sites that don't. So that's important. Okay, so now basically these are the... these are the estimates of the thetas, okay? The cut points and so on. So this is the cut point corresponding to a measurement recorded of zero, and two standard error bars we have around it, and so on. And so this means 7 to 8. Because above that they would be intensity 8. So this is very poorly determined, but you see there is sort of a linearity relationship going along there. And so when I've done this sort of analysis for the Loma Prieta earthquake near San Francisco and the Northridge earthquake down at Los Angeles, I've sort of got nicer pictures than this. This is a harder earthquake to work with because the epicenter was off in is the ocean. Now, for the people, that's lucky that it was off in the ocean, and in the Loma Prieta and Northridge earthquakes, that was right in the middle of center, so there was damage occurring in all different directions. So you've seen the estimated spatial component, and here you have the cut points. Those are the parameters in the model. So basically, the previous picture was the estimated G function. Okay, now we have to assess the fit of our models, and here's the method I've chosen to use that. So here's our model, and the C minus G, that's our linear predictor, and G is smooth. I'm just reminding you of the model there. So what I've done here is for the fitted values of the linear predictor running across the bottom here, I have estimated for those that are near, say, the value minus 10, the probability of going along with that event. That probably I just said on the previous slide. So here we have what should be the standard extreme value distribution. And you see it's doing pretty well down here, and it's not doing so well up there. Now, this is a bit different from previous cases I worked with because they have sort of pretty much followed the curve there. So there's room for improvement of the model, and one possibility is we don't have any explanation there except for the location. Well, for sure one wants to have some other explanatory variables, and we're expecting to getting those. Now, one way to sort of take note of the fact that they're unobserved, unrecorded variables, omitted variables, is to move to a random effect model. And in the random effect model, one might be assuming that the random effects are normal with standard error sigma, say. And so this probability here then becomes that probability there, and you can use numerical integration to estimate the sigma. I'll be doing that in the case of the fire. So I'm sort of waiting on getting the geology data before doing that. Of course, it may be that this extreme value distribution isn't the appropriate one. So we need to sort of hang on to that thought of we haven't fitted the model, we can do better. Okay, I talked about attenuation. So what we have here are parallel box plots of the intensity along the bottom and the distance here. So take that slide. This is representing the distances at which intensity 5 was measured. Box plot, the white line is the median of the values, the bar, the up and top bar here of the box, upper and lower quartiles. This is like 1.5 times the quartile range or something, to give an idea of the spread. And then these are outlying values that are there. But basically, you just sort of see in a glance how variable these things are, and the thing is, falling off in a decaying in a clear manner. I plotted the log. Yeah, that's right. Surface distance. You know, I had the latitude and longitude of those things. Actually, I was going to say to you know your distance you had of space and time? You know, in relativity, you use x squared plus y squared plus z squared minus c squared t squared. Okay? You just had x squared plus y squared plus t squared. You might fiddle with that a bit wrong.
I didn't have t.
Oh, I thought you had it, T. I thought, okay, all right, okay. You had a beer, knowing you, not T. Okay, we can talk about that at some other meeting. So the attenuation law that I fit has been used when you actually have accelerations and things like that. This is now an adjustment of that to apply to ordinal data. and so on. So the physics suggests there are two types of decay of the energy, spherical spreading and I forget the name of the other one. So we have a D term and a log D term in there. And attenuation is very important for building codes because there will be, say, faults in an area, California, they're all over the place, and you'll have a building that's going to be constructed, and you'll know the different faults, and you know their distance away from the earthquake. So you'll want to have the attenuation. When you have a number of earthquakes, you can actually you put a term in here that goes along with the magnitude of the earthquake. And then here's what I got when I fit it using the parameters. So here is intensity 8. So this was the largest intensity observed in this earthquake, and so this is the probability of observing intensity 8 when you are, say, that value there. Where does it go? I'm sorry. This is 8 down here. Hold on. Where am I? Yeah, that's 0. Okay. Give me a moment. I'm just trying to see what's going on the screen here. So 8, 5, 0, 5, 8. Yeah. Okay. So I've mislabeled these. So this should be, this curve here is 8. Is that right? There's a faint 8. Yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway, so let's take 0. So the chance that there's no damage when you're 250 kilometers away is 0. The chance that there's 5 when you're 600 kilometers away is this. The earthquake itself, oh, I see. This is going up there. I can't hardly see it here myself. Anyway, so the chance of damage from an 8 when you're in close is high, but it was spread about. The chance of a 5 was peaking when you're like 600 kilometers away from the epicenter of the earthquake. The distance from Spain to the epicenter was a bit over 200 kilometers, so that's the reason for that scale there. All right, now when you're doing insurance for seismic risk and so on, the way it is often grabbed onto is by a so-called damageability matrix. So remember I was saying how taking the insurance attitude made you look at a lot of different segments of the problem. The geologists will worry about the geology. Seismologists will worry about the magnitude coming from a seismic trace from a time series. The seismic engineer will worry about the damage to the building. The materials engineer will worry about the damage to the plumbing in the building and so on. And then the actuary has to worry about paying out some money to cover the event. So part of the study was concerned with sort of describe the damage in terms of buildings. So the people who collected the data, who brought the data to light recently, they took two types of buildings, masonry, which are traditional houses, and monumental, the castles, the churches, and so on. And so there were a lot of measurements of the different intensities. And then they had a number of measurements going along with the type of building and the different intensity. So, like, take magnitude 8. Those values, 92% of them of the traditional houses were damaged, and for the monumental ones, it was just 60%. I guess they were built to last longer. And then here's the crucial paper that talks about this data, and they sent Bruce Bolton the paper to be. The data to be analyzing. Okay, so now for a change of topic, but the mathematics is and statistics and probability are basically the same, so you don't really need a lot of introduction here. Wildfires, tens of thousands per year in North America, millions of acres get burned up, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on suppression. The data set I'm going to talk about is for Oregon, and this work is, and I'll list some papers, is all collaborative with Heidenreich Preissler. So we had that many fires in that particular time period. And here we go. So the data that we have is for the so-called federal lands, and these are graphed in yellow in this picture here. And here's the locations of the fires. And for some later pictures I'm going to show, you might notice that there are not so many fires down there. And then this is the gray is Oregon. It rains a lot there, so maybe that's suitable. So this is now spatial temporal data. That's why I had a little side about spatial temporal point processes. So here's the temporal side of things. So here's the number of fires And I learned from John Tukey, with a count you want to plot the square root, and that sort of made things look a bit nicer. So this is the square root plotted there. And so you see there's a very definite seasonal effect in this data. Berkson used to talk about the interocular trauma when the data hits you between the eyes. So here we got a pretty clear seasonal effect in that we need to have in our model. And okay, the model. Now, Hagenusch had this up in a form. Basically, we're going to model the logit of the risk. So the logit is the probability over 1 minus the probability as a smooth function of location and as a smooth function of the day of the year. And we're going to have a year effect in there that is going to be random. It's going to be independent, normal, mean, zero, and variance tau squared. And we're also doing some fitting with that, sort of having some dependence present in it. Now, I forget the number, but Hagenusch had it up. There were many, many pixels, voxels with no fires in them. So, and it didn't seem, it was sort of too big for the computer, really. But it was too many fields for being able to do exploratory data analysis. So a sample was picked of these things. And the logit is very special, because if you use the logit and you're working with a sample, you can just take log of 1 over pi as an offset. That's the generalized linear model jargon. And the biostatisticians with their case control studies, they'd learned this quite a while ago, it turns out. Yeah, I'm in PowerPoint here and just sort of clicking through the slides in case you're curious. All right, so here are the results. So spatial temporal. So here is the estimate of the spatial function. Hundreds of kilometers along here, and you'll notice how it is low here. And so this was that lower right corner I pointed to in the slide of Oregon, and this is desert, so there just weren't the trees there to be able to be burnt down, and there's sort of a peak going on here. Then here's the day effect, and see, this is for the fire season. Now really it would be periodic, going from the first of the year through the end of the year, but this is for the fire season starting in April and so on. So we see it going up, and then here we have two standard errors around that. And now these are the year effects. So remember, I had a year effect added in as a random normal variable, and so this is the so-called shrunken year effect, the estimate based on the fitting of the model. And so on. And then here we have the two standard errors around them. So we see it is sort of bouncing around. But we just have a few years of data that we're working with. But there does seem the years do differ, it seems, from this. And whether they're, you know, maybe they're anti-correlated, that would be sort of a surprise and so on. But so we've got estimates of the various parameters in our model there. Now, to make some use of this, one could take a particular region, say, that you're interested in, and be wanting to estimate the probability there's at least one fire in that region. Well, basically, you take all the individual pixels, voxels, so eyes labeling the pixels and the days that lie within this region, and you just write down the expression for the probability. You have a random effect model here, so now I'm going to be integrating against phi. I did that using Gauss-Hermite quadrature, and here is the fitted linear predictor and so on. So basically, to get things like that, you sum over and you can get standard errors from the measures of uncertainty from the values there. And so here's what you get. So here's the for one region that we took, Umatilla Forest. Here is the expected count going along with this random effects model. So there are various models some other models we use with fixed effects and so on. So these are it's not that big of an area. So the number, the fitted number was peaking in July, but there's a huge amount of variability around it. And then here's the risk probability. So this is now the risk of there being at least one fire in the month. So you start the year with it not being high, but then it's at least one fire. So it goes up fairly quickly. Again, you see we've got the standard error. So no surprise, there's a lot of variability in the problem. Okay, so now mark point process. So we had for that data the size of the fires in acres. So here I've simply done a smoothing to estimate the average fire as a function of location, and it's not varying that much. I mean, so here's 50. So it was sort of coming up with an estimate of 50, but see, there are not many fires down there. So this is bringing a different aspect going along with the data set. And here we're just, this is now just showing the dependence through the year of the number of large fires. So large fires were greater than 200 acres. And so if, once again, to make the pictures more easily interpretable, plotted the square root going along with that. And then here is doing that same box plot, lots of outliers, you see, as a function of the year. Okay, now, so I was talking about a damageability matrix and so on. One wants to somehow end up with some premium that people might be expected to pay. So now, we've got some more recent data, but this is sort of from some very large fires. You see down here, millions and so on. So the Forest Service came up with this data. And here, so for there are sort of totals over big regions and so on. So this is the cost in millions of 2002 dollars, and this is the size of the fire in acres, and so you see that there is obviously a growing, there's sort of a suggestion in this data of sort of it turning over. And I seem to remember Dave Martell made some remark like that to me at one point about the very large fires. Well, they're different. It doesn't just keep going on for forever. So we have some more recent data that we'll be working with. That's sort of the project we moved on to next. Okay, so now just to make a bit more specific what the sort of thing is that the actuaries will be using to get an idea of what's going on. Now, there's a lot more sophisticated ways to do this stuff nowadays, but this is sort of one of the early ones. You're going to picture that L is the claims that are going to come in, and I suppose these are just requests for money into the government. For paying for dealing with the fires. I remember Dave Martell said that it was very difficult to estimate how much timber had been lost, and that was very important. So in Ontario, that would be entering into this. The pure risk, so-called pure risk premium, we just say charge what the expected loss is going to be. But there's variability, and the insurance company doesn't want to go bankrupt and so on, so it has to be loaded. It has to be some sort of safety premium. And this is one of the formulas that people talk about, where you're bringing in the variability in this fashion, and to emphasize it more, you bring in this. But you can set up sort of probably a rune question and sort of get a threshold for doing that. Okay, so I'm just defining here. So it's the seismologists, really it's the insurers dealing with earthquake risk who've introduced this terminology, but it seems you can carry it over into a lot of similar situations. Just providing the potential losses from a given intensity. So in the earthquake case, we saw suppose you're the Catholic Church, you got all these cathedrals in Spain, you know, and there's a big earthquake. Well, how much would you have to pay? Well, we had information on the extent of damage amongst them, and then you would convert that to rebuilding a church at modern costs, for example. So, winding up here. So, one point I want to make pretty strongly is that if you just start thinking, well, what sort of fund do we have to have available for paying for these things of great risk, of substantial risk? And you then talk about forest fires or floods or earthquakes and so on, it really gives a focus to the problem. I actually, when I was looking at this Voltaire literature, I found that the Catholic Church got mad at Descartes for a number of reasons. One of which, he said, the way to solve a problem is to break it into parts and solve them and then put it together. I guess the Catholics then thought everything was a whole and should be treated that way. So you weren't supposed to break it up in parts. But, you know, we know how useful system analysis is these days. In case you're thinking I'm a totally anti-religious person, my grandfather was a missionary in China, and then lots of Brillingers in the church historically. Okay, and then there's evidence that it does make sense to treat the intensities as approximately numerical. I haven't really finished up that analysis to my satisfaction. Want to thank a bunch of people, Bruce Bolt, the Spanish seismologist who sent us the data, John Benoit, U.S. Forest Service, Hagenius Price, U.S. Forest Service, and two grants that I worked with. And then there's a lot of work that we've done on this. Here are a number of the papers on the forest fire case. So these are all on my website. And so you can download these papers. I guess this one isn't quite yet. It'll be there. But we sort of, you know, really hit this data pretty hard in a number of cases. And that's sort of the original paper there. And so on. As I say, this is definitely collaborative. So thank you very much. Yeah, being less than or equal to something. Then I went to individual ones, and that was because I could use GLM and GAM to do the fitting. I could have written a general ML, used a general MLE program to get it for any model I had. But see, that one I'm in GLIM, and I got the residuals and all sorts of information. It was that factorization I showed where I converted the probability of, I found how to represent the probability that you get an exact ordinal value in terms of the probabilities of it being less than or equal to the value. It was just Bayes' theorem being used. But this is Dale Prejvon's clever idea to recognize if you use the extreme value distribution, then it's just a change of the constant that appears. Cute trick. Well, these are local analyses. I had that G function, and that was smooth. So I was actually using, in the map case, the thin plate spline, the radial basis function of that. So it's all the data, but really to get the function, we're homing in on the location x, y, but by the averaging that we're doing. It's non-stationary, so you need to be incorporating that. The program here is actually trivial, you know, once you sort of get the conceptual setup. I mean, for the random effects model, you have to do a bit more. I think if you're puzzling, I think you just need to blink and think, and you'll see. Dave Martell. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, the thing is, we're there are thresholds that are involved, and sort of that zeta thing. Suppose you're in time. I picture zeta going along, which represents the chance, the inherent chance of there being a fire, let's say, and when that inherent chance crosses some sort of level, then there's a fire. Okay. So it's a crossing problem. What I want to say, it's a threshold problem, and that goes along with extreme value things. You've got a level, and something's marching along, and we're trying to see when it crosses. Yeah. But you saw it didn't fit, okay? Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I said it was okay in the first place, David. So I don't think I said it was okay in the first place, actually, because I knew this next slide was coming. So this is still research at work, and the main thing we're missing is the site information. You know, there's sites that are on refill, and then there's sites that are on granite, and so that's obviously going to affect the amount of damage that takes place. And so that's just saying there are other emitted variables. So that's what led me to using the random effect model in that case. See, a lot of people don't validate their models, and it means people like you can't ask questions, can't point fun at them. You know, that's their strategy. But I'm an open guy from Toronto, so let it all show. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're trying to estimate the probability of there being a fire as a function of time and location, and uncertainty to go along with that.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. No, that was the X. That, so in the earthquake case, we're just talking about the site effects. No. But again, they just fit in there quite directly, and you can worry about whether interactions. Yeah. Yeah, you know, all these indices, you can put them in and see whether they're affecting the estimate and things like that. It's like regression analysis. You know, least squares and so on. So this is just a fancier form of regression analysis. Yeah.
I'm worried about King of Spain sampling protocol. Does it matter at all that you're probably only getting?
They're supposed to go everywhere. The people. You know, the people who are getting information were supposed to cover Spain.
Really?
Yeah. There's someone from Spain here. Maybe they'll speak for the Spanish king in 1755. I think they did their best to get it all. But I don't know. You know, there could have been some remote building somewhere. Yeah, well, those would be zeros.
But would they have made them?
Would they have made them? Would they have recorded?
Yeah.
No, they did record that was just a sampling of the data. The sampling that went on here was the points I put up there with the intensities, because there would have been overprinting and things like that if I had more. But there's a measurement error. You're talking about 2 days ago. There's measurement error here. I know there is. You know, there's, you know, it's judgment. You know, these Spanish words they were looking at. Now, does this refer to intensity 4 or intensity 5? Right.
In the case where you're sampling a part of your data,
yeah.
Could you just repeat the whole analysis?
Yeah.
Standard errors. Is that how you got standard errors?
No, we were using the delta method. We're using the jackknife, actually. You sort of look at how much time you have to get your talk ready, and with the different methods that are there for getting standard errors, and go with that. No, you could bootstrap, you could jackknife, you could use the delta method, and so on. But you got to get them somehow. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, no problem. You know, you'd call that a measurement error problem, but it's, you know, the maximum, getting the likelihood function, if you just say, I want the likelihood function, and you've got a model, it may take you some while to get it, but you can do it, and Dave was talking about Yossi Agata getting these likelihoods for these very complicated models, you do it.
It was more of a question of whether you find it, whether
it's helpful. Not yet. You might have seen, I had, I don't remember you mentioned, but I had Markov chain Monte Carlo up there in the different inference techniques. So for the underlying spatial process here, I think that's like to go, you know, trying a BSAG model or something of that sort with Markov chain Monte Carlo to estimate the parameters. Well, I think everybody's ready for lunch. Sir.
I wonder if you could discuss this insurance business and risk mapping a little bit if you have some time.
I don't. I'm leaving town. Why don't you send me an email? I've got a couple of papers on it. If you go to